content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2021 Walter Magazine. We begin with the Creators Department. In Moving On Up, History is Brewing Again in Downtown Asheville by Wiley Cash. In 1994, Oscar Wong began brewing beer in the basement of Barley's Tap Room and Pizzeria in downtown Asheville. Wong, the son of Chinese immigrants, grew up in Jamaica and moved to the States to study civil engineering at the University of Notre Dame. After forging a successful career in nuclear engineering, he would later create an innovative nuclear waste disposal company, and then go on to found Highland Brewing Company, Asheville's oldest independent brewery. As the first legal brewery in western North Carolina following the repeal of Prohibition, you can imagine its allure. Still, it took Wong 8 years to break even. Why? Because he was determined to produce a high-quality product on a consistent basis. He invested in his vision. While that superior quality persists, little else remains from those early days in the basement. In 2011, Wong's daughter, Lee Wong Ashburn, officially joined the team at Highland Brewery. More than a decade earlier, Ashburn had applied for a position with her father's company after graduating with a degree in journalism from University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. But her father turned down her application. He wanted her to find her own way, he told her. And so she did. Ashburn built a thriving career in sales and marketing with a yearbook publisher in Charlotte. Years later, her father actually recruited her for a position at Highland. But in the intervening years, the tables had turned. He could no longer afford her. But blood is thicker than water, and apparently so is beer. She came on anyway, making her way up to president and CEO. Other things became more important, and the brewery was one of those more important things, Ashburn said in a 2018 interview with Business North Carolina. It was about being part of the community. You can't put a value on that. Leah Wong Ashburn's tenure has marked an era of rapid change, both for the company and the city of Asheville. In 2011, Highland opened a tasting room in their mountaintop manufacturing facility in East Asheville, which has now grown to 70,000 square feet and offers complimentary tours of their on-site brewery, a lively tap room with ample seating, a performance stage, a rooftop garden bar, and an indoor event space. According to Brock Ashburn, Leah's husband and the company's vice president, we built the taproom to accommodate the throngs of people who were showing up, part of an ever-increasing, interested public who wanted to drink our beer where it was made. Over the past decade, a lot of people have, as Brock Ashburn puts it, shown up in Asheville, and the city is now an international destination for foodies, beer connoisseurs, and outdoor enthusiasts. There's always been a soul and a spirit in Asheville, Leah says, and Highland got to join up with other people who believed in the potential for Asheville. Great beer is a complement to great food and quality of life. Community and regional pride are more than just branding tools. Highland is a company whose culture is built on stewardship and community responsibility. Tenets made apparent in their practices of reducing or reusing waste, partnering with local nonprofits, and embracing solar power. The company also collaborates with the Southern Appalachian Highlands Conservancy, naming seasonal beers after unique regional landscapes. Ashburn has always made clear that she intends to keep the company concentrated on regional endeavors and has no plans to ship beer across the country, choosing instead to focus the company's efforts within the confines of the Southeast. This comes as no surprise for a brewery that has spent 2.5 decades fostering a regional brand in a region that has quickly gained international attention. On the day we meet, Leah and Brock are sitting at the brewery's new downtown taproom in the old S&W building, a quintessential example of Asheville's stunning 1920s Art Deco architecture. Late morning sunlight pours through tall windows that look out on Pritchard Park, illuminating the gold-plated fixtures and ceiling tiles, the two-story marble columns and tiled floors, in a glowing aura that sweeps visitors back into the roaring 20s. You can almost sense what Asheville must have been like a century ago, when it was first known as a destination for Hollywood stars, politicians, and titans of industry. Highland anchors the new S&W Market's downstairs dining area with a tap room, along with several local restaurants that provide counter service. Upstairs on the mezzanine level, Highland has opened a full bar and tasting room with ample space for guests to relax over a pint. One can only imagine what it must mean to Leah for Highland to return to downtown, where it all started from such humble beginnings over a quarter century ago. As a second-generation owner, I was encouraged to make the brewery my own, she says. That didn't feel safe to me at first because of the long history of Highland, but my father's sentiment was honest, and he's let us create our own vision. That meant changing the beer portfolio and re-envisioning the brand. She says it also meant improving the property. We started as a manufacturing company, but Brock's an engineer and a builder, and I'm a marketer, Leah says. Combining all of those interests and backgrounds led to a complementary hospitality component. It appeals to tourists because it highlights some of the great things about Asheville in one location. Outside, people are waiting for the S&W Market's doors to be unlocked for the day's business. A line of tourists and downtown office workers in business attire snakes down the sidewalk. Leah and Brock look out the window and pause for a moment, perhaps recalling the throngs of beer enthusiasts who showed up the minute the first tap room opened in Highland's manufacturing site a decade earlier. The building is an opportunity to tell our story downtown and also attract people to come out to East Asheville to visit, Brock says. I'm happy that we can let people know where this all started. From a downtown basement to a mountaintop in East Asheville to the second floor of one of the city's most iconic downtown buildings, Highland has come a long way. But whether it's the quality of the beer or the family name, some things never change. And from the food department, the scoop. Goodberry's frozen custard is a Raleigh tradition, 30 years in the making, by Hannah Kaufman. On a steamy September afternoon, Emily Speak is singing behind the counter at the Goodberry's on Davis Drive in Cary, scooping out thick, sweet frozen custard for her regulars. There's Blair, who comes in every day for a single cone of whatever the flavor of the day is. We tend to give him a little more custard than we would anybody else, Speak says. And Thomas, who always comes in to get chocolate with peanut butter fudge for his wife. Talk about heaven in a cone. Goodberry's has such a ubiquitous presence in the Triangle, 9 locations in all, that it may come as a surprise that this frozen dessert company was born and bred in Raleigh. The company was created in the late 1980s by Harry Breathwaite, a businessman who worked for Brigham's Ice Cream in the Boston area. He was ready to start his own company, one that emphasized using all natural ingredients, a contrast to what he was seeing in the marketplace. And the Raleigh area, with its growing population, warm climate, and robust dairy industry, seemed like a great place to build it. Breathwaite came up with a custard recipe, then worked with the Dairy Extension Program at North Carolina State University to find a local processor. Its ingredients include milk, cream, cane sugar, eggs, and honey. No high fructose corn syrup, no chemical fillers. It's something akin to what you'd find a century ago. I can't overemphasize how rare it is to be making a dessert without stabilizing products, gums, or other chemical ingredients, says Henry Breathwaite, Harry's son. It's really just not done. And Harry came up with a name, Goodberries, to encapsulate the brand's mission, to build a delicious, high-quality treat with good ingredients. In September of 1988, Harry opened the first Goodberries storefront at the corner of Spring Forest Road and Atlantic Avenue. A second location quickly followed on Kildare Farm Road in Kerry, and within 10 years, they opened 6 more locations. At each location, the experience is much the same. Customers order from a sliding walk-up window, then eat their custard around red metal tables shaded by umbrellas. The goal was to create a space that people could come to, not be rushed, and enjoy the good weather we have in North Carolina, says Henry. A single Goodberries order offers a multitude of choices. Custard, a shake, cake, pie, a specialty sundae, or the popular Carolina Concrete, which has the toppings mixed in. Goodberries offers a big range of both classic and unconventional toppings, from fresh fruits and roasted nuts to crushed cookies and candies. There are 3 everyday custard flavors, vanilla, chocolate, and no-sugar vanilla, plus a specialty flavor that changes daily. Among the rotation, peach, key lime, mint chocolate chip, and coconut. True fans know to check the online calendar to see what's in store. The small size is just perfect, says customer Bryna Freeman. Even the tiny little size is more than enough to make you feel like you had an amazing treat. Just before the pandemic, Goodberries completed construction of a new facility in Wake Forest that brings all of their back-end production under one roof. This is a capital-intensive project that took years to complete, says Henry. Now it's where they receive the milk, all from North Carolina dairy farms, pasteurize and process it, create the custard base, and house all the other ingredients and materials that get distributed to their retail outlets. We even designed proprietary equipment so that we can optimize the way that our product is frozen and served, says Henry. At each location, staffers mix the ingredients on site, adding flavorings like vanilla or pureed strawberries to the base. Each batch of custard has to be made fresh every hour. A training facility for Goodberries locations is in development, a room that'll be the exact layout of an actual store. Because the custard is made on site, it's really important that everyone knows what to do, says Henry. You can have the best ingredients and the best recipe, but if you don't freeze it correctly, you won't have the best frozen custard. Their process is unique. They make their own recipe from scratch, using the most basic ingredients like milk and cream. Most frozen dessert outlets use an off-the-shelf mix from a wholesale food distributor. And their new facility lets them own the product from start to finish, a huge undertaking that positions them to scale up in the future. One of my favorite memories is tasting our first test production batch, which we made here about 2 weeks before the pandemic upended everything, says Henry. Since its founding, generations of locals and fans of old-school custard shops have flocked to Goodberries. Parents who used to bring their kids to Goodberries now bring their grandkids. We're fortunate to have those connections, says Henry. Similarly, he's carrying on a family tradition. Henry started helping his father out at Goodberries when he was 12 and worked with the company in the summers from high school through college. After a little over a year working in finance in Boston, he came back to Goodberry's in 2001, where he's worked in various roles since. "Being in business as long as we have gives you perspective," says Henry. "It really makes you appreciate the community you're serving, as well as the people that work with us to help deliver a great product." Last year, Henry assumed the title of president, running the 200-person company. "I've got two young children, and having a parent who works with frozen custard is just about every kid's dream," he laughs. For Henry, the local focus and community that Goodberry's has built here are as much a part of the brand as the original recipe. "When our customers come to our stores, we have the opportunity to be part of a really pleasant experience," he says. "They're happy to be there, and we're happy to serve them." That attitude comes through with the employees as well. "We like to create a special bond with our customers and make sure that we're putting our best back into the world for them," says Sophia Mellon, a mixer at the location on Davis Drive in Cary. "Over time, Goodberry's has come to mean something different to each customer and staffer. For Emily, it's a dance party with her co-workers in the staff room. For Blair, it's testing each new flavor of the day. For Thomas, it's the promise of being able to bring his wife her regular chocolate with peanut butter. For Henry, it just comes down to the basics, never compromising on the quality of our ingredients, making an all-natural product, and providing exceptional customer service." And next in the vault section, bug out. Citizen scientists contribute to the ongoing study of bugs and birds at Prairie Ridge Echo Station by Hampton Williams Hoffer. Head to the Prairie Ridge Echo Station and you may see an odd practice. Somebody whacking a tree limb with a stick, collecting what drops onto a white sheet below. It's not, in fact, an adult throwing a tantrum, but rather a participant in the Caterpillars Count program at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, NCMNS. Caterpillars Count was launched in 2014 by Alan Hurlburt, a professor of biology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The program welcomes citizen scientists, regular people who need little to no experience or equipment, to download a free app, follow some simple directions, and contribute to an ever-growing collection of data by examining trees to see which insects end up on those white sheets and when. With the help of volunteer naturalists, researchers are better understanding the life patterns of foliage insects called arthropods, which include caterpillars, beetles, spiders, and leafhoppers, that provide essential food for nesting birds. It's a massive team effort, and it all started here at the Outdoor Nature Center. Prairie Ridge Echo Station boasts 45 acres of Piedmont prairie, forests, ponds, and streams near Edwards Mill Road. Prairie Ridge is an ideal location for engaging the public in the wonders of the natural world, says Hurlburt. Once a cow pasture, the area offers a vast array of habitats. As long ago as 1540, explorers wrote of, quote, savannas in the Carolina Piedmont, large open spaces covered in grasses and low-lying plants with few trees. Piedmont prairies never grew as expansive as those in the Midwest due to the rivers and streams that provided fire breaks. But those same rivers and streams add to the variety that makes the Echo Station a naturalist's dream. Prairie Ridge was the project's flagship location, and now more than 100 other survey sites span across North America, from South Georgia to Canada. Within the Caterpillars Count effort, every find, each tent caterpillar or geometer moth recorded on the leaf of a sugar maple, is a piece in revealing answers to questions about arthropods. Insect decline is certainly a concern, but so is insect abundance. Here's why it matters. With climate change, the naturally shifting seasonal peaks, the times where there are the most of one insect or another, can become out of sync with the needs of nesting birds. Migratory birds that winter in Central or South America may be especially sensitive to this type of timing mismatch, Hurlbird explains, as they may be less aware of the extent to which springs in North Carolina are advancing earlier than normal. Caterpillars Count is not the only citizen science project rolling at the NCMNS. This month, to coincide with their annual Bug Fest, the museum is calling on citizen scientists to help find and thus protect the endangered rusty-patched bumblebee. It's an endearing, fuzzy little pollinator, the ideal poster child for endangered insects. Citizen science is a way that anyone can get involved in scientific research, says Christine Goforth, head of citizen science at the NCMNS. You never know when a simple observation you make might lead to a major discovery. She points out that amateur naturalists often, and sometimes unknowingly, contribute to significant discoveries. In 2019, for example, a participant in an NCMNS project called City Nature Challenge took a photo of a random plant simply because it was one she hadn't seen before. It turned out to be the rare and endangered veined skullcap, a flowering plant that had not been spotted in Wake County for 60 years. Scientists immediately began conservation efforts at the site where it was found. For 6 years, Rebecca Ward has volunteered as a citizen scientist on various NCMNS projects. Participating in Caterpillars Count definitely opened my eyes to just how much is going on in trees. I would sometimes go slowly through collecting because I'd be pulling out my phone, taking pictures of what we found, and trying to identify them on iNaturalist or other apps. Ward, who works as a climatologist in the State Climate Office of North Carolina, is a self-proclaimed science geek with an affinity for the outdoors. Being a citizen scientist lets me join both of those passions, she says, while also contributing to something larger than myself. A remarkable 290 unique species of insects have been identified through photos submitted to the Caterpillars Count project so far. Some aren't even from around here. We've realized that the most common ladybird beetle, as in ladybug, found in this area is actually not native, says Hurlbert. Last month, a site in South Carolina found a spider that experts did not recognize. The closest identification they could come to is a spider only known in New Zealand, the white-banded orb weaver, says Hurlbert. With so many hands on deck for this collective project, thousands of insect entries comprise the Caterpillars Count data, which is freely available for anyone to explore on the museum's website. Over just a few sultry June days, participants recorded firefly beetles, Batman moths, coppery leafhoppers, and crab spiders on the leaves of Raleigh's trees. When you slow down and pay close attention to the leaves and branches around you, you realize the tremendous biodiversity surrounding all of us, says Hurlbert. Lastly, Grassroots by Helen Yost, celebrating the beauty and fragility of our native plants. Picture bison and elk grazing across the Piedmont. Can you hear the calls of quail off in the distance, along with the charming lilt of the meadowlark? Now listen. Can you hear the buzz of the native bees and, with the slightest breeze, the rustle of dried native grasses. Hundreds of years ago, the Piedmont boasted millions of acres of grasslands, prairies, and open tree savannas, landscapes characterized by little to low tree coverage. The indigenous peoples helped sustain these grasslands with fires to keep the land open. As European colonists moved in, the Piedmont region lost upwards of 7 to 10 million acres of grassland. Why? These grasslands were open and the easiest to plow and turn into farmland. Within the last 200 years, most prairies were converted into farms and pastures, then into cities and suburbs. According to the Southeastern Grasslands Initiative, about 90% of these precious habitats are lost. As advocacy efforts have grown around preserving native ecosystems, including everything from bees to streams to native plants, local organizations such as Triangle Land Conservancy, the Piedmont Prairie Partnership of the Southeastern Grasslands Initiative, and the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, as well as individual landowners, have been doing their part to restore grasslands in particular. Without these protections, many native habitats would be lost forever. Native grasses filter water and serve as habitats and protection for countless insects and small animals. Flowering grasses attract pollinators, and once the seed heads form, they become a feast for various species of birds, particularly goldfinches, providing nourishing protein throughout the winter. Many birds also make their nests from dried grasses. If you've ever monitored a bluebird box, you may have noticed it used as nesting material. In late summer, female common wood nymphs become more active and deposit eggs on or near host native grasses. Native grasses aren't showy. They don't demand ardent declarations of love, like a majestic oak with broad canopy and strong trunk. But if you slow down and really look, you'll see their subtle beauty, the myriad shades of green as morning light filters through a slender blade, fuzzy buds and blossoms that bring texture to a field of spindly leaves. How the grass softens the rise and fall of the land. These quieter pleasures remind us of how fragile our environment is and invite us to do our part. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.